Welcome to the Independent Thinking Show for Fifth Wrist Radio. This is a place dedicated to showcasing the great people doing interesting things in the world of horology. My name is Roman, and today I'm joined by a new co-host and a Fifth Wrist Radio alumnus, Charlie from Books on Time. Hey, Charlie, thanks for coming on as a co-host.
Thank you so much for having me.
Oh, this is very exciting. I'm really pleased. We're here to talk about the US election. I mean, sorry, wrong podcast. We're here to talk about watches and stuff. Actually, we've actually got something much more interest to most people. We don't tell people how to vote, obviously. Vote Democrat, but it's your choice. We've got a special guest today. We're going to cut all this out afterwards. Don't worry about it. But anyway, more excitingly, we've got a special guest with us. We've got Ricardo from My Watch Memoir. Hello, Ricardo. Wonderful to have you join us.
Hey, Roman. Hey, Charlie. My pleasure. And thank you for having me on the show. Really, really excited to chat with you over the next couple of, minutes, hours, however it may take. But thank you for having me on the show.
We're going to take up your entire day, Ricardo. So hours is preferable.
That works.
Well, you laugh. I mean, our longest podcast to date, I think, has been 4 hours. But this is four hours edited down to 4 hours. So actually, that was Michael Wood's production. We don't know how long it started with. But hopefully, it'll be sort of between 3 and 4. We're aiming for a short one today. What we usually do, look, before we sort of dive right in, one of the first things we do here is we do a wrist check and a drink check. So maybe we'll start with Charlie because he's new on the co-host deck.
Sure. So I am wearing a Bon Mercier. It is a compressor case made by Irvin Piqueras, just time-only simple watch, probably one of my favorite watches I've ever owned, and I just put on a Beads of Rice bracelet last evening.
Lovely. What year is that Bon Mercier?
My Bon Mercier, I believe it is the late 50s or 60s. That's what I've been told. But other than that, I haven't really seen a lot of examples. So it could be any year to my knowledge. I think it's a little bit smaller size. So I would assume it's in the 60s at latest. And apologies, my drink of choice is sweet tea from Dunkin' Donuts.
Thanks.
I think you had sweet tea last time as well. This is your beverage now. We've got you earmarked for sweet tea. That's it. We'll have to provide it from the sponsors.
What are you wearing today, Ron?
So on my wrist is a recent acquisition. I just got a Martin Braun Celine watch, which is a watch from 2010. I was lucky enough to find it in new old stock condition, and it's couple of cool things about it. So it's got a meteorite dial. So it's a meteorite from Namibia. I mean, found in Namibia, originally from outer space.
That's awesome.
Yeah, it's very, very cool. And the other cool thing about it is it has a photorealistic moon phase display. So back in 2010, they actually printed, all the craters and, like the Sea of Tranquility and all that. They printed it onto a little glass dial, which sits inside the watch dial with a second kind of moon, sort of a darker thing sliding over the photo printed display showing the the phases of the moon. So like, I'm super excited about that watch. It is genuinely awesome.
That's a beautiful one.
Yeah, and it was one of the first kind of independent watches I really fell in love with back in sort of early 2000s, probably 2007 maybe, when I first saw it, or 2008. And it was one of those things where, it's one of those watches where when you start out, you sort of go like, who in their right mind would ever spend that much money on a watch? People are crazy. And then, 10 years later, you're like, oh, yeah, no, that's totally reasonable. Anyway, but the fortunate thing is, they come up pretty well. Like, I think I got a pretty good deal on it. So that was good. But, lovely.
I saw it on your Instagram feed, and it looks amazing. And at the same time, like, you had the story that kind of, I think you got first the catalog that was signed by the owners who made the watch, and then you ended up getting the watch like a few years later, right? Which makes it even a little bit more special, I think.
Yeah, absolutely. And I mean, we had a chat with Charlie about horological books and things on a previous episode with Adam. Shout out to Adam at Medium Watch. And we actually talked about kind of, my gateway into kind of watch collecting and stuff was actually through history and through books. So kind of, when I, before you could afford watches, I could kind of buy books. So I ended up sort of stocking up And when I saw that Martin Braun catalog, yeah, it would have been about 10 years ago. You know, I kind of, you know, was poring over that and going like, this is amazing. You know, I'll never buy a watch, but the catalog's amazing. And yeah, it's just kind of a really nice, really neat kind of 10-year collecting arc that really just came together. So yeah, no, I'm totally, you know, for a jaded asshole like me, this is very exciting. So you know, I'm very close to feeling an emotion. So. and
that's awesome.
Yeah, that's really cool. Thank you. And drinks wise, I've got my usual gin and tonic.
Excellent.
With our local Aussie gin.
Big fan of that, right? I heard some of your previous podcasts, and that's your staple drink, no?
Yeah, absolutely. That kind of, you know, it's sort of in a largish kind of vase/aquarium size vessel. Yeah, usually gets me through the first couple of hours of the podcast. So yeah, no, I'm really, really excited.
And Ricardo, what are you drinking and what are you wearing?
On my end, well, what's on my wrist, I actually have I would say late 1960s Galet Multicrone 12 hour, and this is actually one of the watches that got me down the whole rabbit hole of watch collecting. And in addition to that, and it's powered by one of my favorite movements, that's the Excelsior Park 40. And this one has actually the upgraded movement that came out later, which is a 4068, but it's a phenomenal movement to look at and then also to operate. And then on in terms of my drink check, I actually decided that it was a great idea to, thanks to the encouragement of Roman, that I've listened to all the previous podcasts where he always has his classic gin in a scorpion bowl type of us. I decided to go with an Irish coffee this morning. So 8 a.m. I was like, yeah, why not get the blood flowing, get a little bit of scotch in there. So yeah, that's the drink of choice for this morning. Good excuse.
Fantastic. See, Charlie, you can spice up drinks early in the morning. Just taking notes. that's really cool. That's really, really cool. Now, we should also say, you know, in terms of drink differences, it's 8 a.m. where you guys are?
Yep, exactly.
Yeah, it's about 11 o'clock in the evening where I am. So that's often. We should actually probably introduce a location check as well, because I think we've been getting questions from people saying, your guests and your hosts don't match drinks. And it's usually because, yeah, we're on the opposite sides of the world. So Ricardo, maybe a good place for us to sort of start is maybe tell us a little bit about yourself and kind of how you became interested in watches, and then we can sort of dive into a particular, you know, the watch memoir, and sort of we'll go down there. But maybe tell us a little bit about yourself to kick us off.
Yeah, no, it would be my pleasure. It's a little bit about myself. I think as we're catching up prior to the recording of this shortly, I'm originally from Bolivia. In South America, a lot of people in the U.S. Confuse Bolivia with Libya by some reason, even though they're in opposite continents. So I always have to say Bolivia from South America. But in the end, yeah, so I was born and raised in Bolivia, and then afterwards ended up coming to the U.S. for college, and then basically life happened, and ended up staying and locating here in Boston, Massachusetts, where I've been residing for a while now. I'd say over, 13 years, 14 years now. And then, yeah, and then how I ended up getting into watches. I think my interest in watches started at a pretty fair young age. That was mainly, I would say, thanks to my father, who, yeah, he had his pieces, but at the same time, it was when he would travel as a businessman, when he would come back from his trips, one of the things that he would do is like the classic typical father that or mother that travels, that they would bring their kid a little gift. And there was at one period of time where he started bringing my brother and I these little cool watches that were kind of from bands from different countries.
Oh, nice.
So I had like, and I started kind of collecting those little bands that were like a little watch with a band of Germany, with a band of the US, etc. So I think that got my interest into watches, and then that started my little fascination. And then funny thing is that I think I made my first, I would say, official watch deal at seven years old.
Wow.
Because the thing is that I got that interest from watches, and I remember going to school, and we had the classic show and tell activity, right? And I had one of my best friends, his name is Johnny, and he ended up bringing, his dad had like a a travel clock. But it was an electronic travel clock. No. Exactly. Yeah, exactly. But he had like a little, yeah, the gold leather that's perfectly made, buddy. No, just kidding, buddy. So he brought this little travel clock, which was, I think, awesome. I liked it at the time because it was small and it could stand, and it was I think obviously a quartz, and it had this really cool blue light. And at the time, I remember that I had already saved, like, on my piggy bank, I had like $25 that I had accumulated. And over there in Bolivia, that's a lot more money because of the currency exchange rate and all these things, right? So then I ended up convincing my friend. I told him, hey, I kind of lowballed him. I was like, I'll give you $10 for this. And I kind of told him what all the things that he could buy with $10. So then he ended up giving me his father's travel clock that he brought to the show and tell. And I was the happiest guy ever. So I had the clock brought at home. I didn't tell my parents or anything. And then I had it on my mom asked, where did this come from? No, I was like, dad gave it to me. I was like, oh, well, okay, cool. But then that lasted like 2 days. Like 2 days after, my mom got a phone call from the parents of my friend saying like, hey, we found out that your son purchased my watch from on the show and tell event. So yeah, that didn't last long. So.
And Ricardo, do you still convince children to sell their father's watches to you at a low ball price?
That actually should be a new strategy to acquire pieces now that it's getting harder and harder to acquire them. No, that might be a new venture. You're into something there, Charlie. But,
absolutely. Well, I think the lesson of that story is, you know, lying to your parents is always an option. I think we should sort of extract that and say, you know, that's always a good thing to do, particularly if acquiring watches. You know, if for no other reason, you know, lying in pursuit of watches is totally fine. I mean, that usually works well if you translate it to a spouse later. I can certainly vouch for that.
Yeah.
That's a great story in terms of how you kind of got your first interaction with or I guess if your first interest in watches began with something quite, you know, organic and very genuine, rather than, you know, the same story that it feels like we all hear in terms of, oh, I saw the, you know, actor or whatever it is that ended up wearing the watch, and then you go and then you pursue it. Whereas yours is, you know, something very, very pure in a sense. You know, your dad brings back something from his trips. That's quite a cool one.
Yeah, I know. Yeah, and then basically, I think that's I'm thankful for that. But then then throughout my life, like up to college and all these things, I didn't have any fancy watches or anything. I had my typical like quartz movement that looked like a fancy iron steel watch, say, which was the cool thing. But I think then afterwards, I got into watches once I kind of started into my professional career. Then that's kind of where I started to dive in. But yeah, always I've always been fascinated by time, interest, and all these things. Yeah. So,
and Ricardo, you have actually a quite different kind of approach to watch collecting, in that you've got a lot of watches that are not your ones that are in vogue, right? The ones that we see on Instagram all the time. Just right off the bat, you know, I was looking at your account, and you've got some really interesting Gerard Perregaux. You've got Galets. What it is about these, like, I guess the atypical watches or the ones that are a little bit they're a little bit more esoteric, that intrigues you?
So as you can see from my personal, a couple of points. So for my personal collection that you'll be able to find at my personal page, which is at Game of Watches, you'll be able to see that most of my collection is focused on vintage pieces. I may have one or two modern pieces, but I have a love and affinity towards vintage, and I think that comes from I think my mother's side, who's an avid antiques collector, and gave me that poison for vintage love. And in addition to that, I would say that in terms of the focus, I don't think I have like a specific niche that I'm collecting. I think that what I've tried to build throughout the years was kind of a well-balanced collection in terms of different styles. So I would have I wanted to have like a nice collection of chronographs and vintage divers and time-only pieces, dress watches, etc. And at the same time, kind of some different complications as well. So I wanted to have like a split-second chronograph. I wanted to have an alarm watch. and some at the same time looking into some pocket watches. Got a travel clock, a little Movado or Metto, but those ones. So kind of looking into that well-balanced collection throughout the years. And I think on that point of going in, I tried to as well branch out into the off-beaten path, the go around the well-traveled road of common brands, just to mainly try to find additional value. Where that comes in, just because on that end, I think you can find great pieces of great quality, just a little bit on no brands, and then you can get a lot of value appreciation, and then at the same time, you don't have to shell out a lot of money, right? So like very, only a couple of examples like would be like when I started collecting Galet chronographs, and Excelsior Parks, they weren't that expensive, and then suddenly they became more mainstream, and now like that has had a lot of appreciation. But trying to kind of find those undervalued brands or brands that are not that well known that offer the tremendous same value, I tried to do that, and I think I was really happy when in a recent interview I heard Eric Wind talking about the vintage Titus Divers with the Calypsomatics, that he's seen the same quality more or less as the 60s Rolex as well in terms of their build and everything. So I have kind of those two divers, which is kind of where I try to play the value play. So you'll see some of my pieces there that are kind of a little bit from undervalued brands, and then that eventually I think some of them became mainstream as well. But yeah, and I think lastly, the last point I would say in terms of building that collection throughout the years was with a lot of, I think, patience, discipline, and a lot of luck. But yeah, I know that we can go around for hours, because I would also be interested in chatting about your collection and your insights, Roman, as well as from Charlie. So I think, but we can table set that for
this. This is not about me. It's all you. You're the star of the show here. Don't drag me into this. so look, yeah, we got to bring you back. Let me just ask you one thing though. So when you're talking about vintage, because I'm not a vintage collector at all. You know, it's just one of the, for whatever reason, it sort of doesn't appeal to me. When you were talking about, you know, that you get examples of a vintage dive watch and a vintage time only dress watch and things like that, are there particular eras that you select for each? So do you sort of say dive watches, you know, the best, or what attracts me is the 60s and 70s, you know, dress watches, 40s to 50s, pilot watches, 30s to 40s. Do you sort of operate like that, or do you kind of just look at the whole sweep of vintage from any era and just kind of cherry pick what you want?
No, I would say, I think you hit the nail in terms of the eras. So my collection, you'll see, spans a lot of different eras, but I would say that those, you're saying you're not interested into vintage pieces. Mm. From what you just said, you know the eras of those great watches, right? So the divers of the 60s, exactly. So the dress watches you have from the 40s and 30s that are phenomenal, and then chronographs as well, World War II eras from 40s to 50s as well. So it kind of spans on those eras. And then I have a couple of dress watches from the 60s, but yeah, I kind of cover that through that, and yeah, I think my points of references are that when you start looking at those examples, the ones that have appealed to me have been for mainly those eras. So basically kind of zone into those ones and then start from a broader spectrum and then start digging into what style I like. And then basically once I found something that I like, spend some time researching, and then afterwards then trying to find some pieces around those around from similar examples, and then yeah. And get lucky finding hunting in eBay or other places.
Yeah, absolutely. eBay's underrated, particularly for those lesser known brands. eBay sometimes is a gold mine, potentially. Yeah.
No, you can find. Yeah, and then, but I think eBay got so crowded that I think you have to be quick. You have to have your set alarms, basically, and alerts for when something gets posted, and then you have to be already kind of have a well trained eye to kind of see what you're looking for, and have already something in specific that you're looking for, so that because it's a wild, wild mess of whoever shoots first then gets the price and gets to live the following day.
The other thing, actually, just a follow-up question, there seems to be a little, you know, I call it a bald spot of, you know, you get a lot of quality stuff from, you know, 20s and 30s, 30s and 40s with dress watches, and you go 50s and 60s with chronographs, and then 60s and 70s with dive watches. And there seems to be this gap of, like, you know, from 1979 to 1999 or something. Yeah. You know, like, the 80s seem to be this barren. Nobody seems to be collecting the 80s. And at some point, I'm waiting for them to kind of maybe come into fashion with some of those super ornate Gerald Genta pieces or something. Exactly. But just nobody seems to be collecting, or the Pashas or something. Like, nobody seems to be collecting anything from the 80s. Is that fair?
No, I totally agree. And for me, that style, I don't know, the 80s, I think. Awesome music from that era, but it really made this feel that terrible. The design wasn't the best, and there's at least I'm more of a classical. I have more of a classic approach to design, but some of those bigger pieces sometimes, and also I have small wrists, which I can rock the old pieces with, and I'm super happy around that. But the 80s and all these things, you have like bigger, rockier pieces with funky numerals, and you have, it's a lot of different colors, sometimes flashy, the some of the integrated bracelets. That design doesn't appeal to me, but I've been seeing some collectors starting to get into that. And they and start actually, because that, as you mentioned right now, that might be an area of future value that, maybe it's an acquired taste afterwards that develops, and then that may become something that people then start appreciating more. So I think, who was it? It was Phil from a Mr. Enthusiast. So he's also been kind of collecting a Patek Philippe's from the 80s that he says, like, super underappreciated. And then I've started to see some of those pieces, and I was like, they're not that bad. And then second, third time, I feel like, I see maybe what he might be interested in. And then there's other collectors as well. But that void, I think, that you mentioned, does exist. But we'll see with time what happens.
Yeah, and at some point, they must come back into fashion, right? I mean, like, Cartier just released the revamped Pasha collection.
Yeah.
And that's pure 80s to me. You
exactly.
Know? Horrible looking, but now Cartier has made one, and you sort of go, maybe. Yeah. And the thing is, like, personally, you know, and I hope Cartier is not listening, and they probably aren't. You know, the new ones are okay, but if you're going to get the new one, might as well buy the old one. You know, it'll be half the price, it'll be a third of the price, and you know, you're buying the roots of the modern collection in some ways. I don't know, but yeah, it's just, if for some reason the 80s kind of, you know, I'm a child of the 80s, and I was annoyed about it even then.
And I think that's one point as well why I was attracted to vintage pieces when I started, is because if you try to buy a modern piece, it's going to be, you can buy a vintage piece that's going to be cheaper than the modern iteration of something like that. And then it has all that history. And besides, like I mentioned, I love antiques, but in vintage stuff. But at the same time, like, that's also another appeal, which used to be the case with some pieces, but now some other pieces, that vintage pieces, have just exploded in prices, I think. And I think that's thanks to all the social media and all of that, but which has driven that price up significantly. But yeah, that was the other appeal as well, which was nice. But I agree with you, like, you can find still some good value there.
Yeah, no, that makes sense.
Definitely. And just to kind of, transition, you know, we happen to have met through a different account than your personal one with My Watch Memoir. And this is kind of a more personal project than we end up seeing within, you know, these types of, communities, right? So sometimes if you see like a entrepreneurial person enter the watch community and stuff like that, you might be a little bit hesitant to be like, okay, well, who is this person behind it? And ironically, when I messaged Roman, I said, hey, I think that My Watch Memoir would be a great candidate for your next guest. And within like a second, he had messaged me back, but who is it? You know, who is it? And so immediately I sent him your personal account. And I think it was a post that says Master Watchmaker's Reference Library on Complicated Chronograph Watches.
And that book said it was awesome.
It's 27 volumes. And I said, Roman, I'm pretty sure he's one of us.
Yeah. That sold me. But the thing is, that's what I was kind of looking at, you know, because there is a lot of kind of people jumping on the wagon, just kind of just trying to make a buck out of the watch community,
yeah.
You know, whether it's travel clocks or some other things, could be anything. It could be hypothetical scenarios. You know, so it was actually really nice to see somebody who is genuinely into watches, because you could tell from certainly from your personal collection, and then kind of branching out to this really interesting project that you've come up with, the My Watch Memoir. Maybe tell us a little bit about that, kind of the genesis of the idea and kind of what prompted you to do that.
No, that would be great to talk about. And yeah, and thank you for actually judging me for my book cover, because I think that book cover that I had there from like, that helped me get into the podcast. No, just kidding, guys.
Totally.
But in terms of My Watch Memoir, so this how the idea came to be. It was a pretty, I think, organic idea that developed throughout time, and a lot of things interconnecting. Obviously, as a watch collector, once I started my watch collecting journey and I started acquiring pieces, I have a little bit of OCD that I like to keep things organized. Mm-hmm. And then at the same time, I wanted to have everything organized and all the pieces that I had bought. But then I was, okay, I work in finance. So what I started doing was like I live and breathe Excel spreadsheets sometimes. So I decided to create my own spreadsheet of my own Excel about my watches that I have purchased. And I started kind of writing down the key attributes and characteristics that I wanted to record about those watches, which are basically the ones that you see in My Watch Memoir. Like, hey, what's the case size? What's the case material? The lug width, et cetera. All those details, how much I paid, when did I purchase it, from where, et cetera. So I had everything on an Excel sheet, but at the same time, it wasn't a kind of the most user-friendly place, because if I wanted to go and get a detail about my watches, I always had to go and open my laptop, find that folder, because at the same time I had that file stored in my work laptop, so I had hidden a folder within my work laptop, so I had to go scrolling through those, find the file, and then finally do all that. So it was a little bit cumbersome, but it had all the details, which I thought, like, hey, this is awesome to have as a future reference. And then, like, the other thing that was one path that happened. Then at the same time, I was journaling, so kind of recording in the mornings, like notes of appreciation and things like that. So that was one thing that was happening in parallel. And then three, I think what I realized is that in terms of watch collecting, like you, myself, so Roman, Charlie, you, we're here in this podcast because we're passionate about watches, right, and horology. Mm. And if I go and I tell you, hey, if we're in a meeting and I tell you, hey, Roman, like, that's an awesome, cool watch that you just got. Like, can you tell me a little bit about it? Or if I go and I tell Charlie to talk to me about his awesome Volcane watch, like, immediately, I don't know, like, you have this source of joy, like, of happiness that comes out, and you want to tell everything about that watch, right? Like, you were telling me, like, the history around it, how you acquired it, why is it cool, et cetera. So you want to, you have all that knowledge that you want to share, like we did just at the beginning of the show. And in addition, what I realized is, like, hey, not only is it all the cool things about, like, all the technical parts of the watch and why you appreciate it, either the movement or the technicalities or the aesthetics of the dials, etc. What also comes in, which I think is one of the things that I enjoy most about watch collecting, is the provenance of the piece, not only of what the piece brings it with, if it has like a case back inscription, or where it's been, if it was a World War II watch, etc. Or at the same time, the provenance of, hey, how you acquire this piece, like, was it like an awesome find? Or at the same time, like, all the negotiations, or that you found it in a pawn shop, etc. Or also the memories that you build with that watch, right? It might be the watch that you bought when you had your first kid, the watch that you used in during your wedding, etc. So you built all those all those connections and memories to your watches. So then basically those things merged into one. It was like, hey, I need to keep track, like, my log. I have to have, like, I have my Excel log of all the details behind my watches. I know that all these watches have an awesome story, an awesome provenance, and at the same time an awesome a connection to me, that it's something that we love to share with people. And then then there was the journaling event of it. So then basically I decided, you know what, I'm going to create actually a little journal. And this I started by myself on my, I bought a journal and I started creating my, basically the first iteration of my watch memoir is a little journal that I bought, which it was hard to find like a good thick paper to write on to have like a fountain pen because all of them would go through. But in the end I found like, hey, it was okay. So I started kind of doing it by hand. So all the pages to have all those entry logs. And then basically afterwards I shared it with some friends and some collectors. They saw it. They're like, oh wow, this is an awesome idea. I wish I started this as well. You're giving me an idea. And then basically that's how it all started. And then we started down on that process of creating my watch memoir and sharing it with the community. And as you mentioned, Roman, like, I think that there's a lot of people jumping into the bandwagon of trying to make a buck here, a buck there, and from the watch community. To be honest, like, this is more of a passion, a hobby. Mm. And I think you guys are really interested into books and books of horology. You know the economics of books. Like, if I want to make money, I would have to become a New York Times bestseller and sell to every single watch collector in the world. So then it would be kind of something that, okay, I might be able to afford my following piece. But
yeah, no, I think the only way to make money in books at the moment is it has to be self-help, has to do with fitness and weight loss. And you know, somehow get on like a journey of discovery, you know, of yourself, then you're golden, you know, kind of eat, pray, love.
Exactly.
And to that summary, you know, Ricardo, if for anybody who's listening to this, I would go as far as saying, if you can't relate to that, then you're not a true, you know, watch obsessed geek, like the majority of us. I think everybody can relate with that type of, you know, fascination, if not obsession, with your watches. And you know, also to that point where you were joking around of like, okay, I'd have to sell a million of these books in order to finance my next watch purchase. Anybody also could relate with that. I mean, there's no shame in financing the next watch purchase. We could also relate with this. No, but the book itself, you know, it's thoughtful. It provides, you know, a space for you to really reflect on your own timepieces rather than like you and I have chatted in personal correspondence, you know, go and seek out the next one. It gives you kind of that moment to reflect on what you have and be grateful for and kind of practice a little bit of your own literary skills and kind of, you know, reflecting on those timepieces.
Yeah. No, I think you hit it on the nail in terms of that time. And that's something that I think I discovered while I was kind of creating writing my own memoir, because you guys, obviously, as and I think any watch aficionado can say, like, you're always looking for, hey, what might come next? You're always looking out there. And I think that's, I think, where maybe social media plays a part that might be at the service of the community, that it's like, okay, give me more. Mm-hmm. And you're kind of, and people are always like posting their new posts of their new cool watch. And then automatically, subconsciously, that creates that, okay, what am I going to get next? What am I going to show next? Okay, I want the likes. But at the same time, it forces you to step away from that kind of virtual world. And that's something that I think that one of the things that I appreciated is like, why a handwritten memoir is, because one, I realize that we're already spending a lot of time in your computers through work. And then on your phones. And then at the same time, I realized, like, when I was creating my log as well, I was living still Excel, right? So I was like, okay, well, I want to step away from this thing. But then there's something special around, and it's been proven scientifically, look about like pen to paper, that everything that's handwritten, it creates a special neurological path that you're able to recall information a lot faster from your memory. And that's why, like, when people do exams and all these things, all of them, they tell them, hey, if you write by hand, you're going to be able to recall everything a lot faster. And there's something as well romantic about writing your own book by hand around what you have. And it, as Charlie, you mentioned, it gives you that space of, hey, you're enjoying each timepiece that you're writing it in. It's actually writing down all those memories that came with it. And then you kind of relive the past. And then at the same time, it's something that you're going to be able to carry it and give it forward, right? And I think that's one of the things that, hey, might be for your sons or for your nephews or whoever it takes or ends up finding the book like in a couple, two centuries, they'll find like, oh, wow, look at the collection that Roman had. Look at the collection that Charlie had. Oh, wow, this was awesome, et cetera. So it's also that passing down thing that's also super interesting.
I loved it. Yeah.
Yeah. And for those who haven't seen my watch memoir on Instagram, have a look at the account. But just to describe it, essentially it's a diary with blank pages with pre-printed information for you to fill out. You know, so each it describes each watch in terms of maker, relevant details, how much you paid for it, where you got it, what sort of movement it has in it. And, you know, sort of just as a ledger essentially that you fill out. When I saw it, what it reminded me of is, you know, a lot of brands, and particularly I'm thinking of particularly one brand, Breguet, talks about their, you know, their kind of the archives of Breguet, and it's they make a big song and dance about the handwritten archives going back, you know, 1825 or whatever, I can't remember, probably 1790 or something. You know, so it kind of gave me, there's a little kind of hearkening to that of, you know, that each of us is in our own way building some kind of tracking horological journey of your own, regardless of how much you spend, how many watches you have. You know, you kind of have a little pathway where this sort of diary like allows you to actually keep track and flick back through and sort of see where you've come from in terms of maybe your tastes have changed, maybe the pieces have come and gone. But this is a really nice kind of way to, yeah, to reminisce and look back on it. So, which is really lovely. I think it's a really wonderful idea.
Exactly. No, and I think that was one of the things that I think it's when we created the box of sending it out and all these things, one of the key lines that we're using is like create your own master horological time.
Create your own timeless horological masterpiece that will be preserved and cherished not only by yourself, but by generations to come.
Exactly. Oh, wow. Look at Charlie nailed it. Like he had it. I was looking for those words, but exactly.
Photographic memory, baby. I don't even need a my watch memoir. I got all the serial numbers. I'm just kidding. I have that written down. It actually.
But it's exactly what you guys are saying, that you create your own book and you create your own little, and that's something interesting, Roman, that you mentioned about you creating your own archive around those things. And one of the things that I have been enjoying doing is exactly seeing, and I've started, when I started creating my, now I obviously, once I got my official Match Web memoir book, I started redoing everything that I had. And I did it in basically in our chronological order. So then there is where I can see how my tastes change or how kind of, hey, I got interested into certain pieces. And then on a certain time, like I was acquiring only World War II watches or only chronograph watches and then dress watches. I was like, that's super interesting about how to look back and reminisce on your past, basically, around that.
That's awesome. You can literally go and revisit a chapter of your watch, you know, your watch story. And it's interesting that you pulled that quote, because I actually wrote that down in context to one of the questions off the interview. We had spoken back and forth that you were expecting, you know, a new member of the family soon. Did that quote for, you know, in relation to the next generations of being able to cherish these timepieces, did that have any sort of inspiration upon your new family member? Did that have any inspiration for the project by chance?
In terms of the inspiration for the project, the new family member was in part because I started this like officially creating the memoir early 2020. I think that's the only positive thing that I can find of 2020 besides like the kid coming down. But
that was the travel clock. So let's not, it wasn't all bad.
Exactly. Yeah, that's true. Yeah. I'm still looking for that smooth goat skin. But anyways, so in terms of the the inspiration, it wouldn't come, it wasn't related to that. But then afterwards, I think we are all familiar with how Patek came out with that advertisement that you don't own a Patek, you're basically just being a steward and taking care of it for the next generation and all these things. That's kind of like, okay. That was like, okay, that's a typical thing. But then afterwards, what I realized is like, it's the conversations that that we have about around watches, and when we're gathering together like today and chatting about, hey, this is my cool timepiece. It's recording all those things that you would say to everyone that you wanted to be kept afterwards. And then afterwards, then that's where it kicked in about the whole thing is like, hey, if I actually am part, if I'm able to transfer this to my son or to my daughter, like I would like that for them to be able to see that collection and how that came about. And it, so I would say the inspiration for the project, to answer your question, Charlie, would, it didn't come from that, but once I was writing all the websites, once we were kind of putting all the wording together for, hey, what's the value prop of this thing? Yes, then that's definitely where the family member, the family member came into to inspiration for, hey, pass it down. Because at the same time, my dad, like, he has this awesome Rolex that he got. So then I was asking him throughout when I was writing this memoir, I was like, hey, can you tell me the story about how you got this that timepiece? It's a timepiece that he has. He bought it in the 70s. It's been his fellow companion for forever. And it's been like many adventures with him. And he was telling me the story about, and he would remember exactly. He told me that because he bought it in Panama from a jeweler that his friend recommended. And it was funny because I asked him, hey, can you tell me the story about that, about your Rolex? And it's a gold date, like in 1803. And I was amazed by the memory that he had. He remembered his friend that recommended him this guy, who was this guy that was representing Rolex at the time in Panama. And he told me all the details of the year where he bought it from, etc. But at the same time, I realized like, hey, this is where the value of my watch memoir comes in, because I'm able now, I created an entry for my father's timepiece, which still is with him. And most likely, I don't think I'll get it. I think my eldest brother will get it, which is by choice. I told him, hey, you should be the one that gets it.
You're scared he's going to beat you up or something like that still? We got to get that thing for you, Ricardo.
No. I think it was more of a choice. I told him, hey, like you've done a lot for the business of the family. So if somebody gets it, I think it should be you. But in the end, like if he wouldn't, like I wrote down all those things. But imagine if I wouldn't have asked that question, and 20 years from now, when my dad is not present, I wouldn't be able to have all those facts, right? That after you inherit a piece and you don't have all those details, well, now I have them all recorded. And it's a really nice thing to go and look back and actually look at that history. And it's like, this is awesome. So it comes in part with that. So I know that was a long-ended answer to your question. But I think that the inspiration about the project afterwards, about how it evolved, definitely came from that thing about passing it down to my future kid or future daughter, and then or grand or niece or nephew, etc. So.
No, that's great. And it's funny that you referenced your father's timepiece, because when my father comes back to the States, I'm going to hopefully get him to write a few entries into mine. So that way I have a little bit of a different type of voice that I can read from in terms of his, watches that I've gifted him. So that'd be, a fun project to, undergo with him.
Yeah, and just listening to you talk about it now, Ricardo, it's sort of, there's really two functions to, to this, to the watch memo, to the way you've organized it. I mean, you've got the technical details and, at the top, which is really handy to record what you have, but also, let's be pragmatic, handy for insurance purposes, all that kind of stuff, right? Like you need to have that information stored somewhere. So it's actually helpful to have in one place anyway. So that's kind of a prosaic.
Yeah.
It's a collection of insurance details, but that note section, hearing you speak about it, it never occurred to me before. You're exactly right. It's the stories behind the timepieces that we don't really tell others, right? So, so if I think of, the watches that I've owned that I've put on Instagram, usually it's like hey, incoming watch, you don't usually write this whole thing about found it in a, popped it, found it in this little shop in Rome where I was go, you know, you don't record those things publicly where you just say, hey, new watch. Whereas having something like that, you're exactly right.
Yeah.
Having a place where you can actually make notes or little vignettes or thoughts about the timepieces, yeah, it's a really wonderful thing for whoever gets those watches after you, or, you know, even for yourself to reflect back and go, oh yeah, I forgot that's where we got it, or yeah, that's right, this was the circumstance how I acquired this piece or let this piece go or traded it or whatever. Yeah, absolutely. So you've got these two kind of pragmatic thing at the top and actually this really nice emotional side, yeah, alongside it. That's a really wonderful thing.
Yeah, no, exactly. And I think just to add on to that, as you're mentioning, there are certain things that you want to keep personal, right? You're not going to go and put it out there in the whole wide web and for everyone to know. So those little details, you want to go and keep them for yourself or for your future generations of your sons, granddaughters, etc. And then see those things, and it will be fun as well to see how things evolve with time. Right now as well, we see how timepieces have dramatically appreciated over the last like 5-4 years. That prices of timepieces that you could buy under like $500, then suddenly they are trading like at 3,000 or more, and it's like, oh wow. And then afterwards, you're going to be able to see it's like, hey, maybe. And that's one of the things, one of the jokes that I make on the, I don't think that a lot of people have gone into those details in the website, but some people have emailed me and told me, hey, actually, I read that. It's awesome. But it's like the little joke that I mentioned about, hey, like the purpose of this is like, hopefully it will be passed down in your family afterwards. But and what I mentioned is like, hopefully you'll be able to see either your granddaughter or your son will be able to see like, hey, the great watches that you own, the great trades that you make, or basically they may want to kick you in the shin for having made a nonsensical watch trade. That so that's the thing. And you know what happened as well? On a little tangent similar that I just found out, which. Right now we're talking about this whole connection, right, that we have with our timepieces, that eventually you're going to see that progression, share all those stories, pass it down to the generations. You'll be able to track all those things. So last week, no, like a few weeks ago, I think it was Baltic came out with their new line, right, of the,
yes.
the, yep. the new pieces, their new chronograph and their new best watches. So I was connecting with Jess, who's kind of like the designer that helped design the dial for that, and we were chatting about that, and I was fascinated by the design. I love what Baltic has been doing. I think that's going to be my modern neo vintage piece. I think that's going to be, because most of them, as I mentioned, have been vintage, but I think that's going to be my next modern piece. But when I started browsing through the website of Baltic and reading through the history of the brand, and looking into what Etienne, the founder, had put out there, then I found that if you go into their website and look into, I think it's into the history or about us. And actually, I was blown away. And actually, Etienne, if you're going to listen to this podcast, which of course you will, I'm gonna actually be sending you a watch memoir, because what I found there was amazing. So what happened was that Etienne, I think his father passed away, from what's publicly disclosed there. His father passed away when he was a very young age. And I think he inherited his father's pieces, like I think in a suitcase, some of his father's collection, and a journal. And the journal is right now, when I read through that, it gave me goosebumps. Oh, wow. Because it's exactly what my watch memoir was and is right now. So it was his father's logbook, where he would recorded his collection of the pieces that he owned and where he bought it, the prices and all these things. And the Tien mentions like, hey, this was the gateway connection with my father, who I didn't get to know because he passed away when I was very young. But I got to know who my father was through what he did and what he recorded on this watch journal. And I was like, oh wow, this, and I was like, ah, you know what? if somebody happens to do that with my watch memoir in the future, I'll be a happy camper. So I actually I'm gonna be reaching out to Etienne and sending him out a watch memoir just so that he can create one for his future generations. I read that got kind of goosebumps. I was like, oh wow, this is amazing. So that was awesome to read.
Yeah, I just looked at the page right now, and it's like you're saying, it's very reminiscent of what you're doing, just the black and white photo of it. And to that point as well, regarding Baltic, we were just talking in the little chat group that we've got for Fifth Wrist, and you know, those watches are fantastic, you know, as good as it gets in terms of value. So congratulations to Etienne on the great work, but also that's a great story that you've shared with us. Thank you, Ricardo.
It's interesting because, I mean, that's how collections used to be recorded, right? So before, you know, we moved to this Instagram online age, I mean, if you think of the great collectors, and I know we're not, none of us are great collectors, well, maybe Charlie is, but you know, if you think of historically significant collectors, you know, whether it's collectors of anything, Pierpont Morgan with books or with art or even with books, if you think of, you know, like Cecil Clutton or David Solomons with Breguets or whatever, they had a similar sort of thing. You know, they would note down what the watch was, how much they paid, you know, what was so special about it, the movement, whatever, you know, the type of escapement. And eventually those sort of books became source materials for when those big collectors passed away and, you know, Christie's, Sotheby's, whatever, organized those big sales. You know, the sale catalog was actually essentially that, you know, my watch memoir or their watch memoir, you know, with the prices removed. Mm-hmm. But having that record of information that they've lovingly created and consolidated into one place. And I know none of us are, you know, collecting at the level of, you know, we're not building museums here, but each of us in our own way, I think, has a journey that they're moving to, you know, that they're going through, whether it's watches in this example, or books or rugs or stereo systems or whatever people collect. If you collect anything, if you aggregate anything, you'd want to have some sort of system of cataloging it and, you know, being able to recall that information. So it's a really cool thing. I think you're onto a winner with the memoir. That's really cool.
Thanks, guys. Really appreciate that you guys have been enjoying it and appreciate it and like understand you can relate to the passion of that. So that's awesome. I'm really happy about that.
The other question I was going to ask you about is there's some details on each of the pages which I find really interesting and I think I'd like you to talk about. So at the bottom right corner of every page that you enter at home, there's some, you know, there's a drawing of a particular detail of a watch, whether it's an escapement or a shape of the hand or balance spring or something. What was the inspiration of that? And did you select these images for a particular reason?
Yeah, no, they're pretty cool. First of all, I think I want to ask the question to you guys. What did you guys think about those images? Like, did you guys like them or what?
Awkward pause. No.
Look, actually, I really liked it, Ricardo. I think, it highlighted to me that you care about watches in a sense, you know, that this wasn't just like a piece of stationery that you've just thought up as a list. You know, this actually, like, you know, there was a few things, like there's a page with subdials and I'm like, oh, I wonder why he picked that particular subdial and hand shape. Or there was a, you know, there was a page with fonts or with a case back or something. And I think that really reinforced to me that watches are a thing that you're interested in because you pay attention to those sort of details. So yeah, no, I think they add to the kind of the charm of the book.
Awesome. What about you, Charlie?
I definitely enjoyed it. You know, I liked the fact that it was not something that was just a screen print of what Rolex's Explorer dial looks like, right? You know, it wasn't just copied and pasted onto it. It appears to be a reinterpretation or a hand-drawn reinterpretation for the timepiece that was what I'm assuming was sentimental value to you, or maybe something that you spent, you know, a small period of your life just being obsessed over and had to be included within the pages. I mean, there's things like the sector dial for, I think it's for the Patek 130 or something like that. You know, only somebody, again, to make the point of someone within the watch community. Only somebody with a genuine passion would think to put, you know, a specific dial configuration on the side of the page or a bumper movement with, you know, the springs on it. You know, these things aren't necessarily your go-to, you know, mainstream type of appeal signals. They're something that's a little bit more of a purist perspective. So I enjoyed that.
That's awesome. Yeah, no, and basically, so for, I think you described it accurately in the, on that Roman about on the bottom right, on the right-hand entry side, that's, it's a basically a horological hand-drawn artwork. And each of those pieces, I think of those drawings are when I was putting up kind of, hey, what drawings do I want to have it? Because as you mentioned, I just didn't want to create like a basic logbook that stationary that's like a piece of paper, and because anybody can go in and just buy a piece of paper and create their own, right? But I was like, hey, let's add a little bit more value to that. So in addition to already kind of having the pre-printed section where you can enter all those details, I was like, the nice touch, I think, will be to add hand drawings of important pieces. And horological connections, one, hand drawing, because one, you're already doing the handwriting in this book, so I didn't want to go in and put in like any picture in there, just a copy paste of just source some photos and put them in there. But I thought it was going to be a little bit more special if it was a hand drawn horological artwork. And then at the same time, the pieces in terms of what I wanted to show there is like maybe it came from what pieces that maybe. I think if you are going to go and look through that, you're going to see a couple of interesting movements from chronographs. Like I kind of highlighted the historical chronograph movements that they were drawn there. So you're going to be able to see your Excelsior Park, your AP4 movement. You're going to be able to see your Caliber 321 from Omega, the Longines 13ZN, your Movado in 95, you have that bumper movement. Actually, I have a Patek movement in there, which is one of the timepiece onlys. And then at the same time there, you're going to be able to see, as well as you were mentioning, additional, besides the famous like Malju 72, etc. So kind of the main, the grandiose movements that everyone always looks to observe and has just appreciated the beauty of the design of each of those movements. I think there's also the Minerva, the 1320 in there. So I try to incorporate all those movements in addition to hey, cool things that we would be able to see, like little details on timepiece entry number 7. There were all the different, I grabbed 7 different fonts of the number 7 that are printed on different styles, right? So that's why, cool. Like on the number 7, that's why you have like 7, the number 7, but printed like 7 different fonts. Then you have like the main springs, you have
different. Ah, cool Easter egg.
I didn't notice that either until now. Good pointing out. Thank you. I was trying to figure that out the other day. I was like, what is.
Exactly, there are the 7 different numerals that are going to be appearing on dials. And then basically it was like, I love, like I was like, hey, let's draw some case backs in there or some. So that's why I had a like the historic clamshell case that's drawn in there. I like that Bonclip bracelet. I have the Alpina Grin dial. So interesting designs that I really appreciated. So I kind of try to balance things out between movements and then additional horological things of interest for everyone. So yeah, a little bit of flavor for everyone.
Okay, so now here's the moment of truth, Ricardo. Can you quiz Roman and I on one or two or so to see who is the more intelligent watch enthusiast of the two? Hopefully one of us will come out with a right answer.
Yeah.
Oh, I'm a good host. Charlie, I can crown you now. That way, see? I will do a French retreat. Yeah, no, that's all right. Let's do
you
it.
You got yours with you, Roman?
The French retreat. That's awesome, buddy. Yeah. So if you guys have your memoir handy or no?
I do. Cool. Roman, what about yourself?
Yes.
Okay.
Yes,
like yep. let's see if you
yep.
guys can,
got it in my hand.
Can find. Let's we'll start. No, it's going to be too easy. You're going to be able to identify that. Why don't you tell me if you can identify where the Longines 13ZN movement is?
That one is.
I see. I have got no idea.
I think I do know this one.
Five?
I don't think it's... Wait, hold up.
No, five is the Caliber 321. That's the Omega Caliber.
Is the Longines one...
Yeah, see, vintage thing is not my thing.
Is it number...
Oh, that's cool.
Is it number nine?
Oh, wow. Yes. That's awesome. I'm impressed. Well, you've been staring from your feed as well to your master Longines Goldberg book, right? So
no, I've got Google open. I've just Google imaged it so I can make Roman look terrible.
That's fine. Yeah, I usually can do that on my own. You don't even need Google for that. See, there you go. See, I told Charlie, you can be crowned the champion of this podcast while Ricardo and I are on mute.
Exactly.
And just flipping through it to make a point that you were talking about earlier in regards to, you know, the paper quality. I was having this conversation with somebody who had done a self-published book the other day, and it's nice to see that there are the details like this, these personal details added, but also the, you know, quality aspect of the book is on par with what one would like. You know, these pages are all crisp. They're not, you know, rough to the touch. They're smooth. You can write on them and have a really good, you know, impression of ink on them. So, you know, those little tiny details that have been added on a personal level is nice that they were paired with, you know, the quality details that certainly weren't overlooked. I mean, the book is a fun thing to hold in hand and write into.
Wow, that's awesome. Yeah, and that took us actually a lot of time. So when I was, that took me a lot of sourcing when we were discussing it with the different manufacturers, and they were sending me paper qualities and all these things. And one of the things that a lot of them offered to me was, hey, we can do it. You should consider a lower quality of paper, because this is what was qualified as archival quality, which basically will keep the ink for decades. And at the same time, I think if you compare it to the grams of, like, I think it's 140. So it's basically double the standard of basically what's in typical stationary pieces. So that was one of the things. And that's, we didn't want to cut any corners on that end, because I think the quality one, we noticed that obviously watch collectors have a keen attention to detail. So hey, they're going to notice, any watch collector is going to notice all the little details about the drawings, all those things. But at the same time, they're going to feel the product, they're going to feel the paper, and they're going to notice that it's a high quality product. I had one supplier that offered me, hey, it's going to be cheaper. I can produce it for almost like half the cost if you use the lower quality paper, and you can make a little bit more money. I was like, dude, it's not about making money. I want the high quality product. And then, yeah, it's not that. And then, yeah. And the other thing as well, I think that was in terms of additional details as well that I added towards the end, that was a conversation that I was having with some friends, was towards the end of the book, you also have we added the timepiece service log, which was a cool idea to add in, basically you can keep track of all the timepieces that you serviced, the ones that you owned, when did you service it, how much did you pay it for, because I think that's also a key aspect that you have to maintain just for your watch collections, a hygiene, and then so that they don't go on service for too long, and then that way you have a clear service log around that at the end of the book as well. So that was the other key addition that we added afterwards.
Very cool. And the other question I had was thinking about, you know, watch collectors around the world. What has been the response from, you know, people around the world to my, you know, to the watch memoir? Have you been getting orders from kind of all over the world, or is it more European or South American collectors that really gravitate to it? Or is it a fairly uniform kind of, you know, global natural response to want to write things down and, you know, hold on to that?
Yeah, no, I think I was surprised, because I thought actually that most of the orders were going to come in from the U.S., because I know that there's a lot of U.S. collectors. Mm-hmm. I thought the majority was going to come from the U.S., but actually the majority of the orders have been global. Yeah, there's been obviously the U.S. orders and all these things, but at the same time I was surprised by how many orders have come from all around the world, from... Which comes to that point that you were mentioning, that it's such a global community, which is awesome because I started to also make new friendships with people from Bahrain, from people from Dubai, the great collectors that we have in Asia. We have people in Singapore and Thailand, people in UK, where was it? UK, Italy, Spain as well came through. A lot of Italian collectors as well, obviously. Like they were the guys that started most of it a while back. But yeah, and then of course, I would say like the strangest place that I got an order from, I would maybe say like there's a lot of strange people in Australia, so maybe Australia. No, actually, yeah, no, we got a couple orders as well. we got a lot of orders as well from Australia. So yeah, unfortunately, the response has been really positive. A lot of people were the feedback has been like, hey, this is a great idea that I didn't think about it, and now they're starting to appreciate it. And I was like, yeah, no, it's awesome. So that positive response has been great. And then yeah, seeing the global community and building new friendships is awesome. I really enjoy that.
Yeah, and that's certainly, I'm discovering doing this podcast and sort of meeting people, interesting people from around the world. That's really been, for me, the revelation of kind of the best part about the Fifth Wrist sort of family that we've built up is, you know, I got to meet Charlie, I got to meet, you know, like a whole bunch of people that we're all into the same hobby, but this has really allowed us to connect on kind of a really nice, meaningful level, which I think has been really wonderful. And I think having something like the Watch Memoir and being able to kind of, you know, see people, you know, sharing, you know, pages that they've written, you know, and like, you know, sharing it around, or even, you know, I can envisage, you know, going to a watch meet at some point, you know, in 2029 when we're allowed out of our houses. You know, I could see people, you know, bringing their watch memoirs together and kind of just swapping those around, because you might not bring your whole collection with you, but having something like that where you can just, you know, flip through somebody's book, that's actually kind of a really neat thing. Really, really cool thing. Yeah. So no, that's lovely. Really lovely thing.
And that's one, I think that was one of the things as well. If you go to our website, I think we wanted to highlight the portability of the book. And it was like, I think that's one of the wordings that we used. It was like, hey, take it everywhere and take it to your next watch enthusiast gathering or your brunch date with a fellow collector to go ahead and show that, because yeah, you don't want to be carrying your whole case with you, right? Or maybe some pieces that they have already gone, and then you're reminiscing about, hey, this piece was something special. So yeah.
And the portability aspect of it is very on point. I mean, it has got a, you know, a hard cover, but it's also got what feels to be it feels to be designed for somebody who their intention would be to go on the go with this journal, as well as the elastic, you know, band that allows it to keep covered, so that way nothing, you know, tarnishes the papers. I mean, it is a great on the go type of resource.
So thinking about your own kind of horological journey, Ricardo, and just looking at, you know, your own watch memoir that you've written in and all that, have there been any pieces that you've, you know, looked back on and thought, oh, you know, that's the one I've sold and I really miss it? You know, has it triggered that kind of nostalgia point for you? Is there a particular piece that stands out?
Yeah. I think everyone, I think all collectors will have their point of regret, right? Because, I think in terms of something that I let go, that I kind of miss, and I was thinking I should have not let go. It was actually not the watch itself, but what I found was it was a jacket, a bomber jacket. So basically, what happened is, I think this is one of the best finds that I have recorded in my memoir, and I think of my watch collecting journey so far. Is that I bought a bomber jacket from Goodwill. This was it's actually a Vietnam era a bomber jacket. But this jacket had a bunch of patches from, like, you had, I think, on the, you're going to be able to see it if you go to my personal page on Game of Watches. But it's a bomber jacket from the Vietnam era that had a bunch of patches, and it was from Captain. It said Captain J.J. Crowder, and it had like patches from that it had been out in the Pacific and missions like all over the place. And when I bought that jacket, I think I purchased it from Goodwill. It was expensive. Because then I Googled the guy, and I bought it for like $800. And oh, wow. This piece, and afterwards, once I started, but I was like, yeah, it's a great piece. And how I decided to pay that, because I went quickly into eBay. I saw more or less what they were trading for. And like the ones that were in good quality were actually trading at like 2K or 3K.
Oh, wow.
So I was like, oh, okay. Yeah. I was like, okay, this is for military aficionados, this is going to be a cool thing. And I was like, yeah. So I bought it. But then what was amazing afterwards was the story behind the bomber jacket, that this captain, J.J. Crowder, was a captain, highly decorated captain from in the U.S. Navy, U.S. Navy pilot. So what I ended up finding was that this guy had served both in World War II and in the Vietnam era, in the Vietnam War. And the coolest thing, though, what happened was when I was going through the jacket, when I put the jacket on, once it got in, something pinched me on the inside. I was like, what the hell is this thing? And when I went and I opened, I was like, what? Then it felt like a pencil. I was like, a pencil might have fallen through one of the pockets and got inside the seam. So basically, I went in, I tried to get the pencil. I was looking at inner pockets where it was. And then once I put my hand inside an inner pocket, I found the coolest thing. I found the departure notes from the airfield next to the White House. So it's like pilot's notes about how to land on that airport.
Wow.
And the coolest thing inside that, I found his watch. There was a Waltham FSSC 88W, which is basically the U.S.
You're
Navy
kidding.
Version of the A11 that they had, the military watch, the A11, that's basically considered like the watch that won the war, that was issued to most of the troops, to the GIs and everything in World War II. But this is the Navy version, because this pilot, he was a U.S. Navy pilot. So this was the U.S. Navy version of it, which had the loom hands. And I was like, wow, I was just completely like blown away. And I was like, this is one of the coolest things that I found. And
that's insane.
So then I got the watch serviced. So it's part of my collection of my World War II piece. I think I have like six pieces of World War II. But then I was like, when I was trying to fund my future purchases, I was like, okay, I'm going to keep the watch, but I'm going to sell the bomber jacket with the notes. And then I ended up going ahead and selling that. I sold it for like, I don't know, close to 3K, I think, just the jacket itself. I was like, okay, I'm going to sell the jacket because one, it was too large for me. And then two, like, I think somebody else will appreciate this more than I do.
Sure.
And then at the same time, I was like, okay, and this might help fund my future watch purchase or fund for the one that I already bought and I couldn't afford. I was like, okay. So then that was the thought process. But now I still have the watch, and I still have the pictures of the jacket and all those things. But the only thing that now I regret is like selling that jacket. I was like, ah, shit, I should have kept it. But in the end, I was like, yeah, I ended up letting it go. And then that's part of life, though. But then you can reminisce on that story. And for me, that's one of the best entries that I have on my watch memoir, because then when my brothers read the book, and I had one of my brothers actually read that entry, he was like, oh, wow, this is amazing. Like, this is one of the best things that I had. And then I dedicated like that post on Game of Watches. You can see the post of the jacket. And then I also put in a couple pictures that I found from Captain J.J. Crowder, that he was a really famous guy. He was even, like, I think, the commander-in-chief of airplane carrier in the Pacific. So, and ended up being like one of the lead guys in terms of developing photographic air flight pictures, and like an amazing career, military career. And I don't know. I think maybe the family might have donated the jacket to Goodwill or sold it, or I don't know how it ended up in Goodwill. But I was able to find like amazing pictures of him. And at least now I have his watch.
Wow. So that's provenance right there.
That is crazy. That's kind of that's why, you know, the people who buy new never get those stories, right? So goodwill is always worth going through.
I like that you had mentioned that, you know, the fact that, you know, okay, so I want to buy a new watch perhaps, and the jacket itself is valuable. It's got some sentimental value to yourself, but it doesn't necessarily fit at this point in time for you, or somebody else could appreciate it. That's the type of collector's mentality that's often missed. You know, a lot of us have watches that sit around perhaps, and they might be something that somebody likes, but they're not necessarily something that the person is wearing and appreciating and is thinking about the next person who might spend a lot more time enjoying that and having a real, you know, appreciation for that item, whether it's a watch or whether it's a bomber jacket. I'm sure that, you know, once 2020 ends and, you know, people are going to watch meetups, you would be, you know, happier than anybody could ever imagine if you could show up in a bomber jacket with the watch and really stunt on people. But, you know, that type of, you know, approach is one that I think is a much more humble and a relatable type of, you know, approach to collecting.
Yeah, no, that's awesome. And actually, the funny story is that after I sold that jacket through eBay, but when I was looking at price assessments, funny thing, I reached out to Antiques Roadshow. Yeah. You guys know that. You've seen all the episodes, right? That they have the crazy watch finds there. So they have them. They have a section there about military experts, and the funny thing is that you can they provide the contact and you can email them. And when I was trying to get an assessment, I was like, there was five military collectors there, the experts. I went and I shot a note to every single one of them, and I think three out of five replied, and actually one of the guys told me, hey, if somebody's offering like around the $3,000 that they're selling, he told me sell it, just because from a standpoint, the really expensive jackets are World War II ones, the bomber jackets. Vietnam era ones are more common, but given that this guy had actually served, so it might have been the jacket that he wore when he was serving for already in the Vietnam War. But since he had already served in World War II, maybe he already had a previous jacket, but still it had the history and the great military career of Captain J.J. Crowder. So then the guy told me, you know what, if it would have been a regular Vietnam era jacket, that would sell for the $800 that he paid, but it will have that premium. But funny thing is, I sold it through eBay afterwards to this military collector, and I guess that collector sold it to somebody else, because I think it was last year that I got an email, a random email, a contact, a DM through Instagram about a guy that he told me, hey, I bought this jacket from another collector. And I guess he was asking where I had gotten it from, because I think one of the patches had fallen. And he was wondering if I had still the patch. I was like, no, sorry about it. Like when I sent it, it had all the patches, but I don't know, like maybe try to find it on source one on eBay or something like that. But it's funny how everything comes back. And
good thing he wasn't coming after you for the watch though.
I never said I had the watch when I was posting it or anything like that. Then afterwards I posted it. Yeah.
And we should also say, actually, you know, if you rock up at a watch meet and you're coming in wearing a bomber jacket, you better be a pilot, otherwise you just look like a dick. So I think we should say that.
Or you better have a genuine pilot watch.
Well, yeah, but even then, you better have parachuted over enemy lines or something, because, you know, it's, you know, I don't know, that's a bit funny. But what's really interesting is that, you know, we often think about objects, you know, we don't always talk about objects having this sort of permanence, you know, things that were made to last and lasted through years and decades and acquired, you know, patches and names and, you know, kind of the real patina of use and love and being useful for their purpose. You know, that's a really wonderful thing that is kind of dying out a little bit now. You know, people don't keep clothes that long. You know, things are made more disposable. And I just wonder whether, you know, the three of us and the nine people who are listening to this whether we all share that romanticism about watches, because they are that sort of offer that permanence, that mechanical watches at least, we're not going to toss them out when the operating system changes, like the Apple One or something. You know, these are the things that have inbuilt permanence. You know, I just wonder whether that's why we're all talking about watch memoirs and, bomber jackets from World War II, or, fixing Waltham watches from, that era or something. Yeah, just something really romantic about it.
Yeah, no, I have to agree. I think looking back and seeing how things were built in the past, I think now that you get to appreciate the quality that was put in. As you mentioned, now it's more of a disposable and more of a, transactional society right now in terms of what you keep on buying. But at least watches will continue to have that built-in quality, I think, thanks to the watch enthusiasts that continue and expect to be able to for watches to carry that that tradition of being highly built and of high quality that they can transcend through future generations. But yeah, it's something that, things are, you get to appreciate more. And I think I got to appreciate a lot of that vintage and an appreciation for antiques, what I mentioned through my mother, who was the one that she collected a lot of vintage stuff. So I think, you go there, my mom, her house, you can go, when you go to my house in Bolivia, you can sit on a bench that was part of a monastery, like a Spanish monastery from the 1700s. Wow, this thing is so well built. Like, it's solid wood, like oak, and it's like that thing will last decades, right? And I think with watches, that's something that, maybe as you're mentioning, maybe just collectors that, where we got infected with this wonderful disease of watch collecting, are the ones that appreciate that. But I think collectors as well, of all sorts of things, get to appreciate them. But yeah.
Yeah, absolutely. And sort of what's next for you so you've got the My Watch Memoir. Is there a follow-up or what's kind of the next project or what's on your horizons next?
There might be a next project that I'm thinking about it. But in the meantime, right now, I'm just enjoying doing my watch memoir, because at the same time, I think if you guys go into the Instagram page, I'm enjoying not only kind of building the community of my watch memoir and seeing all the great collectors join and share their stories with me and build all those relationships, but at the same time, I'm enjoying like creating, because I just didn't want to create a website or an Instagram account where it's just pictures of just my watch memoir, right? So at the same time, I'm really enjoying creating kind of like a great page where people can go in, and I'm putting like my series right now, what I have in place is I post pictures of my watch memoir, but at the same time I add pictures of great watches that I saw that were auctioned in the past. And I put a lot of the details around all the watch that was auctioned, so that people can go ahead and kind of develop some and look at the great pieces that were auctioned in the past. And at the same time, I'm adding that additional series of where I kind of every week I put in some interesting watch facts, so that people go ahead and can read through those. So I'm so far that has been really good, and a lot of positive feedback from a lot of people that are actually experienced collectors. They would reach out to me and was like, oh wow, I didn't know that fact. So yeah, I'm really enjoying my watch memoir. So I think right now we're in the infancy stages, but it's going great so far, and I think that's going to be the just continue growing this and while I enjoy it. So yeah.
No, well, we're loving the the community element that you've established to it. You've got featuring interesting collectors, you've got watch facts, you've got a very personal element to the page. It's really a beautiful thing, so we look forward to watching more of its development and growth.
That's awesome. Glad to hear that. Thank you for the kind words.
But no, that's brilliant. Absolutely. I totally agree. Well, look, as we start to wrap up, the last thing we do, one of the things we do here is we ask our guests and ourselves for an Instagram recommendation or a cultural recommendation of some sort, which sort of allows us and our listeners to kind of expand their horizons and grow and learn new stuff, which is always a nice thing. So I might throw it to Charlie, put him on the spot, given that he's his first co-host.
Yeah, sure. Yeah, so recently I just discovered after going back to a post that I had saved a few months back that there was a book that was self-published by an account called Watchistry, and it is called Marine Nationale. Yeah. Awesome. And what it does is it has, yeah, it's a fantastic book, and it's also kind of an interesting thematic approach to, you know, writing a book. Most of the time we look at books that are going to be based off of one brand or, you know, one type of era of watches, whereas this book has a theme around French military issued watches dating from 1940s, I think the early 40s to 1998 at latest. And it has a wide variety of watches, you know, pocket watches, you know, it's got aviation watches. It's also got G-Shocks. It's just a really interesting kind of approach to a book. And it's also one that I would certainly recommend to people. So if you end up going to Watchistry, their account, and they also have a really interesting YouTube channel where they have kind of paired a lot of these Marine French Marine watches with basically like a YouTube review. And so that's certainly one that I would look into.
No, that's awesome. And yeah, and correct me if I'm wrong, I saw that. I've been following their page, which is awesome. And it's interesting. That book, I think it's, correct me if I'm wrong, but from my understanding, it's only for the watches, the timepieces that were issued to the French Navy, right? So that's a money missional.
Yes. So it's a small curation. It's about 34, well, not small, actually. It's about 34 watches that are, you know, detailed within the author's collection. So it's kind of, in a sense, like his journey into collecting French military watches. And it's a wide variety of brands, styles. It's very thematic in that approach, but there is a lot of diversity in what you're going to be looking into. And the book quality itself is really great. It's under $100. That's always another plus for anybody who's into watch books. You know, it's always a little bit easier to justify a book under $100 than like a $400 purchase. I mean, it's a great book. It's something different and very niche.
That's cool.
Very cool. Very cool. I might go next and we'll leave, I guess, to go last, I think. So the person I've got to recommend is probably one of my favorite accounts on Instagram, period. Watches or not watches related, just period. So it's at Levin Art Group 1. So LEVINART Group number 1. So it's run by Todd Levin, who's an art consultant. Who's very thoughtful, wonderful guy. I think he's been on Hodinkee Radio or Talking Watches or something. Like amazing taste, but he's the only person I know who wears a George Daniels anniversary as his daily beater. That's a watch of 1 of 35 made. He's also got, I think, a Daniels Millennium watch, and he's also got a Philippe Dufour Simplicity as well. So it's a neat little collection.
Oh, wow.
You should say that. But Todd's like a lovely, lovely guy, very, very thoughtful, you know, lots of stuff about architecture, lots of stuff about art, lots of stuff about jazz and a few other things. But yeah, like a fantastic account, lovely guy as well to interact with. So highly, highly recommend it. So at Levin Art Group number 1.
Definitely a good account.
And what about you, Ricardo?
So I've been listening to your previous podcasts, and of course you guys have had amazing recommendations or the past. So I didn't want to be repetitive, so I was trying to figure out, okay, I was looking through back, I was like, god damn it, they already selected one that was going to recommend. But I don't think One interesting account that I think has one of the best, if not the best, Omega collection of vintage pieces that doesn't have that many followers. I think it only has 700 followers, but the collection is absolutely insane.
Oh, wow.
It's he's an Italian collector, and the name is Tuotolo. So it's Tuotolo. So Tuotolo, I think. Mm-hmm. that's how you pronounce it, or I don't know how he intended it to be pronounced, but the pieces that you're going to see on that account are just absolutely amazing. Yeah. You have amazing chronographs from the 30s from Omega. You have dress watches. You have an amazing, insane of like historical pieces, like the Cosmics, like a square Cosmic Black Dial that I have never seen before. But it's an amazing, amazing collection of pieces. Yeah, wow. And when you just like, I think I would use that as a reference. But the shocking part is that he only has like around $700.
Yeah, that's crazy.
So I was like, oh wow,
that's crazy. Fantastic. Wow,
a lot of value here.
Yeah, amazing. Yeah. Fantastic. Oh, you got to leave it to the Italians to do these really cool collections.
Yeah
that's amazing. I mean, that is amazing. And very like very tricky, but really incredible. Yeah, cool.
Let's go.
And that's why this is kind of one of my favorite parts of the podcast is doing these kind of things, because you always learn something new. You know, like some of these people, I don't know how they stay so little, you know, under the radar with some of the collections or some of the content they have. That's really, really cool. Alrighty. Yeah. Well, look, I think it's been a fantastic conversation. Once again, Ricardo, really want to thank you for coming on, having a chat with us. I think hearing about the passion in your voice, describing this sort of personal journey and the project that you've started, yeah, it's been wonderful. So I've really, really enjoyed it. What about you, Charlie? What do you think?
Well, it's fantastic. It's always good to, you know, first of all, chat with my new best friend, Roman. And then we've also got Ricardo in the bunch. So he's going to be in our text groups. He's going to be hanging out with us.
Such a charmer. Such a charmer, Charlie. No, I agree. Guys, I really was really excited to come in, and it did not disappoint. I actually had a blast. And yeah, no, at the same time, I know that we have been kind of either text via Instagram. I've been using a lot more the voice feature over Instagram, sending voice notes. Some people find it weird sometimes when they just receive a voice note out of nowhere from My Watch Memoir saying like, hey, this is Ricardo from My Watch Memoir. But I think that's helping me connect a lot more with also our great customers.
Yeah, for sure.
And also building new friendships with you guys. So at the same time, I'm really, really excited to also continue to see this friendship flourish. And to be honest, like yesterday when I was going to bed, I felt like when you feel like a little kid when you're about to go to, and Christmas is the next day, you're going to open your presents. That's how I was looking forward to the podcast. So I was really excited. So no, I'm really happy that I had such a great time with you guys. So thank you for being awesome hosts.
Oh, that's all Charlie's fault.
Yeah, mutual experience in terms of opening up the My Watch Memoir. You get a handwritten note with it. I mean, that type of personal, that personal relation with people who are passionate for the right reasons is always a pleasure. So we thank you, Ricardo.
No, thank you, guys.
For sure. And just the last thing we say is, Fifth Wrist, we set this up as a platform by enthusiasts and for enthusiasts. So for all our listeners, if you want to join us, contribute, write reviews, or even come on the podcast and have a chat with us, please get in touch. Follow Fifth Wrist on Facebook and Instagram or on our website at fifthwrist.com. Like and subscribe to the podcast. Leave us a review. We love seeing your reviews. Helps us spread the word. We also learn what is going on in the world. Follow me. I'm at TimesRomanAU. Charlie's at books_on_time. And our guest today, Ricardo, is at game_of_watches and also at My Watch Memoir. No underscores, thankfully. And mywatchmemoir.com. Thanks for tuning in and joining us today. And as we always say, stay on time.